Rejoice. Rejoice in the Lord always. Again I say, rejoice. Today we celebrate the third Sunday of Advent and the antiphon. The entrance to this Mass begins this with these words of St. Paul, an exhortation to rejoice always in the Lord. And it's an invitation that can give us joy, but at the same time, there's a part of us that might start to wonder if we look deeply. Rejoice always? Is it actually possible to always rejoice? Are we not seeing a little bit of toxic optimism in St. Paul? And I think we all know a few of those toxic optimists, or at least kind of know the type. Those people that say, no matter what the situation is, that it's going to be great, everything's going to turn out okay, and sometimes you just kind of want to strangle them, and you're like, no, life is really tough right now, it's really bad, I don't need you to be telling me that it's going to be okay. Was St. Paul a toxic optimist? Who's just telling us, you know, just put a smile on and go through life and it's going to be okay, some sort of self-help, pop psychology? Or was there something deeper? St. Paul is writing this from prison, similarly to where St. John is in today's gospel. And Paul had a lot of things going on in his life, and a lot of things happened to him. In one of his letters, he recounts everything that happened. You know, he was shipwrecked. He was stoned a number of times. Not like New York City street corner stoned, but like actual rocks were thrown at him. A lot was going on in his life, and he had a lot of emotions going through. So what is this rejoicing? It's interesting if we look to the Latin to nerd out for a second. There are three types of joy in Latin that in English we would translate as joy. The first is laetitia, which is the joy that we normally associate joy with. Going to a party, the joy that we might feel going to a wedding, seeing the bride and the groom rejoicing this new life, a new reality coming about. And then there's the joy of exultatio, which is the joy that's expressed in Mary's Magnificat, when she meets with her cousin Elizabeth and she expresses this joy in the Lord, almost an ecstasy. And then there's a third type of joy that's called gaudium, which is perhaps a slightly humbler joy, but it's a deeper joy. It's an all-pervasive joy. A joy that we can say as Christians is our inheritance as baptized people. It's our inheritance. It's something that's stable and sure. It's our safety net. It's the basis of who we are. And we have, coming back to the gospel, this encounter between John and Jesus. John's in prison. He's living in terrible conditions, in a pit filled with rats and other things, other types of vermin, and very unsanitary, very unhealthy, not seeing the light of day. And he sends messengers to Jesus, and you can almost feel and experience the tension in his heart as he reaches out to Jesus with this question: are you the one who is to come? Or do we have to wait for another? You can almost feel the sadness and the cringe in his eyes as he asks that question, as he allows that doubt to come in. And who was John? John was the one that leapt for joy when he and Jesus encountered in their mother's wombs. You know what word was used for joy in that gospel passage? Gaudium. That deep, pervasive joy. Now they're together. John is questioning. There's a deep angst, a desire to know if what he's living right now is actually part of the promise, or if it was all in vain. And it's beautiful in this dialogue that's going back and forth between John and Jesus. They're both quoting scriptures. John is asking if Jesus is the fulfillment of scriptures. And Jesus, instead of responding with a yes or a no, responds with the promises of God. Responds with Isaiah. And they're both quoting from different chapters within the same book. And Jesus responds with the part that's a little further on, the second half of what we read this morning. And he responds showing what he's doing. The blind will see. The crippled will walk. The poor will have the good news preached to them. This joy. And in order to understand this, I think we need to look at the geography of salvation. This book of Isaiah was written in the moment of the return from the Babylonian exile. And it shows another stage of Israel's geography, and it's the geography also of our souls as Christians, as believers. We have the Exodus story where the Israelites are enslaved in Egypt. They have to cross a desert to get to the promised land. In the Babylonian exile, they were exiled to Babylonia, modern-day Iraq. They had been there for hundreds of years. They're finally released. They have to cross the desert again to get back to the promised land. And I think those three aspects are very important for us. Exile, desert, promised land. And the thing about the exile for the Egyptians, or in Egypt, when the chosen people was in Egypt, and when they were in Babylon, those who were finally released, that was just the lot that they had received. They were born into exile through someone else's fault. And sometimes that happens in our own lives. We're in a situation, and it's not of our own fault. Somebody else's choices, what somebody else did, has put me in this situation of exile. And I have this desire in my heart to get to the promised land. We all carry that desire in our hearts. But we have to cross through the desert. And I think today we are spoiled because we don't have to walk everywhere. In Jesus' time, if you wanted to get from Babylonia to the promised land, you had to walk through the desert. There wasn't any other way. I was born and raised on the West Coast, and I've lived on the East Coast. So, sorry for all the Midwesterners there, but the flyover states are kind of a thing. There are no flyover states in our lives. You have to walk through that desert. And what's happening in that desert? And there's a very subtle promise in what we read in Isaiah. And he speaks of three places: Lebanon, Carmel, and Sharon, or Sharon. And those are three places within the promised land. And each one of them has significance. Lebanon was a place of fertility, a place in the mountains, a place where the cedars of Lebanon, these beautiful trees that the people of Israel would contemplate. But you know what it also was? It was the place that they sourced the cedar wood to cover the Holy of Holies. It was what was in the sanctuary of the Holy of Holies in the temple was cedar from Lebanon. Second place, Mount Carmel. Mount Carmel was a place of fertility, a place with a view of the sea, a beautiful, beautiful scenery. But it was also a place where the vineyards that produced wine were. And Sharon is a plain close to the sea that's also fertile. And what grows there is wheat. And as Catholics, those images should be setting off fireworks in our brains. Temple, Holy of Holies, wine, bread, Eucharist. And it's not a place of arrival. The promise in Isaiah is that he will send those things into the desert. He will send to the pilgrims who are walking through that desert, who are returning from exile, he will send them sustenance. He will be with them there. There's a desert in Chile, the desert, it's called Atacama. You can look it up later, and it's called the Painted Desert. And it has a particularity that it only rains there every 7 to 10 years. And in between those years of rain, it's just a barren, dusty, hot desert. But when the rain comes, there's an explosion of life. Within an hour, flowers are blooming, grass is growing, animals come out that you never even expected would be there. And this desert that hours before seemed like a place totally devoid of life, all of a sudden sprouts, and there's beauty and life and abundance and fertility. And it's an image also of our lives. We are invited to walk through the desert, not as just an obstacle. It's not just a flyover place. There's a process that the Lord wants to work in our hearts through that desert, through that place, that our faith grows there, that knowing that we are on the path, knowing we are in the correct direction, gives us that hope, gives us that joy. And there's a rabbinic text that talks about the miracle isn't that there's fruitfulness in the desert, but the miracle is being able to remember that there's fruitfulness in the desert when we're not able to see it. That's faith. So we have these two great figures of our faith. Paul, who's writing from prison, inviting us to rejoice. Not just putting down our feelings. Not just putting on a good smile and walking through things. No, it's about experiencing the fullness of life, the sadness, the joys, the anger, all of the gamut of human emotion. But there's this underlying, pervasive joy of knowing that we are on the path. And that Gaudium that we are invited to live, that Paul lived, that John lived, that Jesus lived, that Mary lived, is knowing that we're exactly where we need to be to take the next step in our journey, and that everything we need for our journey will be given us. We are not alone. He walks with us and will sustain us.